Thank you, Charles.
It is obviously a great honor to be asked to introduce as distinguished a guest as we have with us this evening. It's an honor for me, as has already been indicated, not only to welcome our distinguished guest on behalf of the Vancouver Institute, but also to extend a very warm welcome to you, sir, on behalf of Simon Fraser University. We're obviously very delighted to have such an eminent guest with us for a period of time next week. While it's clearly an honor to be able to introduce a man of Professor Calvin's caliber, it's also very difficult because someone very kindly sent me along a copy of those hideous things we in academic circles use called curriculum vitae. And I can assure you that if I were to try and cover his vitae this evening, there would be no need to call on him because I would take up all of your time. And so what I'm going to do is to try and highlight as briefly as I can some of his many accomplishments in order that you might have some appreciation of what it is that it's possible for a single individual to do. Undoubtedly, he has had a bit of assistance in that regard, and we're very honored to have his wife, Ginny, with us this evening, and I'm pleased to welcome her as well. Professor Calvin, as noted in your program, has a name professorship in chemistry at the University of California, Berkeley. He's a former director of the Laboratory of Chemical Biodynamics, and he is a man who has conducted research in his field of chemistry, but in a broad range of areas within that field. These areas include metal organic chemistry, the chemical origin of life, photosynthesis, bioenergetics, chemical and viral carcinogenesis, and solar energy. His numerous honors, and let me tell you, they are numerous, include the Nobel Prize, which he was awarded for chemistry in 1961. Excuse me. It was awarded for his work in photosynthesis. Professor Calvin was born in the state of Minnesota in 1911, received his Bachelor of Science degree from Michigan College of Mining and Technology in 1931, and then went on to do a PhD at the University of Minnesota and completed that in 1935. After postdoctoral study under Professor Michael Polanyi at the University of Manchester, Professor Calvin then accepted a position at the University of California, Berkeley in 1937, and he has obviously enjoyed that experience, and that institution has undoubtedly enjoyed his experience because he stayed there ever since. As I've already indicated, he's a married man, and he and his wife have three children. I said to you earlier that it was difficult to try and identify his many accomplishments in just a couple of minutes. Let me say to you simply that he is a profound academic. His accomplishments include 7 books and over 550 technical publications and a whole variety of patents. He has served on a multiplicity of scientific boards for the United States government, including the President's Science Advisory Committee for both Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. He was chairman of the Committee on Science and Public Policy of the National Academy of Sciences from 1972 to 1976. He has also been extremely active in a variety of professional societies. For example, he has served as president of the American Society of Plant Physiologists and president of the American Chemical Society. He has been elected to so many honorary bodies, including the National Academy of Sciences in the United States, the Royal Society of London, the Japan Academy, and such a host of others that I can't begin to repeat them all this evening. The Royal Society awarded him the Davy Medal in 1964. Other awards have included virtually every distinguished medal of the American Chemical Society, including the Priestley Medal, which is their highest award. As well, Professor Calvin received the Gold Medal of the American Institute of Chemists in 1979. He has been awarded 13 honorary degrees from very prestigious institutions, including Oxford, University of Paris, and Columbia University. His most recent research has involved using the principles of photosynthesis as a renewable resource for energy, and as well, materials and basic studies in solar energy. One cannot help but be totally overwhelmed by reading the accomplishments of such an individual. I think we are very privileged this evening to have him as our guest, and may I ask those of you who are in attendance to welcome him in the usual manner. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Peterson. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very much impressed with the size of this audience. First of all, it's Saturday night. But it's not only Saturday night, it's a Saturday night before a Monday holiday. And as I said earlier to some of your officers, I find it difficult, in fact, I usually avoid trying to give a lecture anywhere at 4 o'clock on Fridays. And here I am, on 8 o'clock on Saturday, with a holiday on Monday, trying to do it. And I'm really impressed with the enthusiasm of the population of Vancouver to be here tonight. I hope I make it worth your while. Now, the subject, as it's announced, I'm not sure I know what that is growing and engineering hydrocarbons. And the reason that we're interested in this subject will become apparent in the first few minutes of what I have to say. My wife and I became concerned with this subject in 1974, or thereabouts, I think, during the first oil embargo that we suffered in our country. And she sent me out one Saturday morning to fill the car with gasoline during that period, and I had ample time to think about the problem, because I had to find a gas station that was open, and secondly, after I did find one, I had to stand in line, and that line went all around what we call a block, four sides. And I had to start at the back, at the fourth side, the end of the line at the fourth side. And eventually, after about 2.5 hours, I got to the pump. Well, that gave me plenty of time to consider what the implications of this event were, for not only for us in the United States, but for the world as a whole. It was obvious that this was the beginning of a new tool in foreign policy for the United States, a new pressure point which we had to reckon with, and that this was going to get worse and not better, no matter what happened. It was going to get worse. And the reason it was going to get worse was obvious, to me at least, had been for some years, but I hadn't really given it that much thought until this spectacular occasion forced it upon us, is that we're running out of oil. Now, you may not think so in Canada, but the fact is you are. The amount of oil that has been deposited in the ground is finite. It was the result of ancient photosynthetic processes, and those took a finite period of time and laid down a finite amount of stuff, and we're using it up. What is the evidence that we're using it up? And what can we expect in the near and more distant future? And the first picture is an attempt to show you what that is. Now, what you see on that first picture is a description of how many barrels of oil we have been finding in the United States, and actually it goes for the whole world, per unit of effort, and we measure the effort by the number of feet of well we drill. And you can see that by whatever measure, the oil found per unit of effort, per unit of foot per foot of well drilled is falling. And by these two lines, these straight lines here and here, sort of bracket the actual experiment, historical record. The actual historical record, of course, is not smooth, it's rough, and what these two lines, oil low effort, oil high effort, are trying to bracket is the overall effect that is taking place. And you can see that both the oil alone and the oil and gas together are falling rapidly. Now, what you see, for example, look at this line here, 35 barrels per foot of well drilled in 1945 falls to something less than half of that in 1975. That progression is going to continue. Another way of describing it is to describe the energy cost of drilling and extracting the oil. Now this, of course, is rising. It's a mirror of the other one. They both measure the same kind of a quantity, but measured in different ways. Now, the next picture extends that data. Here, these are the same four that you've just seen, and here's this energy cost of drilling and extracting the oil. Now, the two are going to cross somewhere in the year before the year 2000. What that says is that about that time, 20 years or so from now, the energy cost of finding and extracting a barrel of oil will be equal to or exceed the energy content of that barrel of oil. Has nothing to do with dollars. No, it's the energy cost of extracting, of finding and extracting the oil. As you well know, drilling in the Arctic or in the North Sea is very much more difficult and more expensive than drilling in the Gulf Coast. And that's what this tells us, that the energy cost of finding and extracting the oil we can expect will exceed the energy content of the oil somewhere between 1995 and 2000. That's about the expectation. And that's really a world expectation and not just a North American expectation. Now, when we see numbers like that, as they have been seen in our country for some time, the next thought is, well, in our country at least, we have another fossil carbon, another fossil fuel, in much larger amount, which we have not been using in the last 20 or 30 years, namely coal. And the suggestion is, well, we have no problem, or we have a problem but not a too serious one, we can turn our attention to the enormous deposits of coal that we have in the United States, which are very large indeed. In fact, in terms of the oil that we have already used, the remaining coal in the ground may be 10 or 20 times the amount of oil that is available in the United States. So that we have enough fossil carbon in the form of coal that to last for several hundred years, even at double the extraction prices that we now have. Well, there is a limit to that. Some years ago, we were advised for environmental reasons to transform our coal-burning power plants to oil-burning power plants because of the environmental costs of mining and burning coal. All the usual things, that is surface mining or deep mining. Surface mining destroyed the land, deep mining destroyed the miners, and burning the coal destroyed us all because the coal in its effluents made acid rain, which we are suffering from today. It is very poor in hydrogen, therefore it produces a substantial amount of carcinogenic hydrocarbons, which come out the stack and are exposing all of us to their effects, not only the smokers but the non-smokers as well. And so there were many reasons for abandoning the use of coal in the power plants and going to oil. Now we are told, because we're running out of oil, we should go back to coal. Well, all those problems are still with us. But there's one problem which we didn't recognize 20 or 30 years ago as a serious, which we do today. And that one is not soluble by the methods which could solve all the others. We could avoid the risks of surface mining. We could avoid, we could avoid the environmental damage of surface mining by reclaiming the surfaces. We could avoid the risks to the miners in the deep mines. We could avoid the risks to the general population by absorbing the acids from the stacks, so we wouldn't have acid rain. We could avoid the carcinogenic hazard that is produced by burning coal, by burning it more efficiently, so there wouldn't be any carcinogenic hydrocarbons coming out the stacks. But there's one thing we cannot avoid if we're going to burn coal, and that is the production of the combustion product of coal, the total combustion product of coal, namely carbon dioxide. There's no way to get the energy out of coal, no matter how you burn it, whether you burn it as coal or you liquefy it first, or no matter how you burn it, you must produce carbon dioxide, and you must produce twice as much carbon dioxide per BTU of coal heat as you do per BTU of oil heat. The reason being that oil is made up of one atom of carbon with two atoms of hydrogen, whereas coal is one atom of carbon and less than one atom of hydrogen. And so you don't burn any hydrogen, essentially, when you burn coal. You burn only carbon, and therefore you must produce roughly twice as much carbon dioxide per million BTUs when you burn coal as you do when you burn oil. Now, that carbon dioxide production by the burning of fossil carbon is a serious problem, or is beginning to be a serious problem. And the reason is that we are generating it, have been generating it, even with oil, at a rate far in excess of the rate at which the biosphere and the oceans reabsorb it. And the next picture shows that. Here you see the history of the carbon dioxide level from 1958 to 1980, roughly. And each season, in the winter, the carbon dioxide rises, in the summer it falls, in the winter it rises, in the summer it falls. It never falls as much in the summer as it rises in the winter. And the result is, this is at a station in Mauna Loa, the result is that it has risen from 315 parts per million in 1958, roughly, to almost 345 parts per million in 1980. Now, that's a historical fact. I mean, those are not projections. That's the record as you see it, the actual record at one station. Actually, the record at several other stations, one at the North Pole near Point Barrow, Alaska, one at the South Pole, and points in between, all give the same result. The carbon dioxide has risen, and roughly 5% in the last 15 years. Now we can extrapolate, or we can make an estimate of the level that carbon dioxide had 100 years ago by measuring the amount of radioactive carbon that's in a tree ring that was created, that was grown about 100 years ago. And from that, we can calculate what the carbon dioxide level was when that tree ring was actually produced. And we know then that in roughly 1880, about 100 years ago, the level was not here at 315, but was at 290. So in 100 years, roughly, in 100 years, it has gone from 290 to 350, roughly. It has gone up about 15% in the last 100 years, of which one-third, 5%, occurred in the last 15 years. So it's going up much faster now than it did in the first part of that 100 years. And that's to be expected. We are burning more fossil carbon at a higher rate today than we did 100 years ago. If we turn to, and most of this, you see, was made by burning not coal, but oil. If we turn to coal, the rate of production is going to double, and the rate of absorption will not change. It'll remain about what it is now. That means that the rate of rise of the CO2 in the atmosphere will go up by a factor of 2, roughly, from what it is now. Now, why should we be concerned about that? The reason we should be concerned about that is that the CO2 has some peculiar physical properties. It is transparent to the orange visible light of the sun, which all of which is converted into heat when it strikes the Earth's surface. And it doesn't matter where it strikes the Earth's surface, the oceans, the land, the trees, it doesn't really matter. Ultimately, it's all converted into heat and re-radiated as red light or infrared light out into space. Now, the problem is that CO2, as represented by this orange blanket, is opaque to that red light, absorbs it, and reflects it back down. That means that the CO2 blanket acts as a one-way valve, letting heat from the sun in, energy from the sun in, and not letting it back out into space. That means that the Earth's surface must ultimately warm up. Now the question is, in the 100 years during which the total amount of CO2 in the atmosphere has increased by about 15%, can we detect that heating up effect yet? And that's what the big argument is about. You will undoubtedly have seen in the newspapers and magazines discussions more and more frequently as to whether or not the CO2 effect, the greenhouse effect, is really occurring. Well, I want to show you three or four somewhat, well, more or less independent observations which convince me that it is occurring, even though it's still within the norm, almost within the normal noise fluctuations in time and place of the average temperature of the globe. It's very hard to make that measurement. We need really an integrating measurement. That is one that adds up over time and space, the average temperature change. Measuring temperature changes at any one point over a period of time and trying to average those is very difficult. So I'll start with that, which is the most difficult measurement, and show you that 1981 sets a modern heat record. And this shows you how it fluctuates from year to year, from 1880 to 1981, and 1981 is the highest point in that whole set of numbers. But you can see on the average it's been rising. But you see how noisy it is. Now, can we find some integrative measurement that will add up all this effect of time and place? These are all European measurements, by the way. Not North American. Those are European measurements. Now, is there some way in which we can do this? And I think there is. And one of the better ways, one of the best ways that I know about, is the ice that accumulates at the poles. For example, the Antarctic ice cap is not floating on water. It's mostly sitting on a rock base. And it's possible to measure how much ice there is there, and the amount of ice will be an integration of how much cold weather that the Antarctic has been subjected to. If, on the whole, on the average, it's getting warmer, there should be less ice than there was 100 years ago. Well, unfortunately, we don't have satellite pictures of the Antarctic ice cap of 100 years ago. We didn't have a satellite then. We have a satellite today, and the next picture is the satellite picture of Antarctica in color. The color is a measure of the temperature, and the temperature scale is shown on the right, on the right-hand side there, if you can see it. That's the temperature scale, and as you see, the blue colors are the coldest parts of the Antarctic. That means the ice is thickest here, and it gets thinner near the edges. Now, you can measure quite accurately the size of that ice cap, and fairly accurately the thickness. So the total amount of ice is estimable from such a measurement. Unfortunately, as I say, we had no such satellite photos of Antarctica, even as late as 10 or 15 years ago. But we do have fairly good atlases of Antarctica, which were made during the land rush toward Antarctic by the United States Navy and by the Russian Navy in the last 50 years. And so we compare. It's not a good comparison, but it's the best one we've got. The satellite data
with the surface data as collected by these two navies. And when we do that for a relatively recent period of time, we find that indeed the Antarctic ice cap is diminishing.
And this gives you some idea of how much it's diminishing. And it's a little too light. Let me turn out another light. Maybe you can read that scale over there. I don't think you can. That's 10 million kilometers.
10 million, it's 12 million. The top point is 13 million square kilometers. That's 12 million square kilometers. And then it's 11. That line there is about 11. And that's 10 million square kilometers.
So the Antarctic ice cap seems to have decreased about 2 million square kilometers in the last 10 years. Now, that's calculable in terms of volume of water, and it's so big that it should make the ocean rise. And indeed, the next picture shows sea level history for the last 100 years, and you see that the sea level has been rising from 1880 to 1940 at a rate of about 1 millimeter per year, and from 1940 to 1980, about 2 millimeters per year. In other words, it's rising faster now in the last 20 years than it did in the last 40 years than it did in the previous 40 years. And this is, I think, independent evidence that the warming effect is indeed occurring. Now, what is the consequence of this warming effect, or I should say this melting of the South Polar ice cap? Well, and the rise of the sea level. Well, the sea level was much higher 50,000 years ago than it is today. In fact, we know that from the fossil measurement, fossil observations on the south and east coast of the United States, and that black part that you see there is what was underwater 50,000 years ago. It's quite obvious that if this continues, this melting continues, we will lose Florida. I don't know how much of Vancouver will be left, but some probably will be left. Pardon?
Simon Fraser will be left.
And I think that this is enough independent evidence to warrant serious concern for those programs which project an enormous increase in the use of coal. Now, where is the coal on the globe? It's not only in the United States. There are two other places where there are large amounts of coal, three other places. The Soviet Union and mainland China both have very large deposits of coal. In fact, they're using them at a great rate. And finally, of course, Western Europe. Germany is so almost solely dependent upon coal. Now, the biggest exporters of coal are the United States and Australia, but the largest burners of coal, today anyhow, are the Soviet Union and mainland China and Germany. So I urge a concern that this be reduced and certainly not increased, and for the reasons that I've already given you. Now, if that is the case, then what are we to do for liquid hydrocarbon, which is the basis, really, of not only of our modern mobile society, but of our modern chemical industry? What are we to do for the liquid hydrocarbons, for fuel and materials? And the only answer to that is to use the sun, the sun's conversion ability, on an annual basis. Every year, the sun is collecting some of that carbon dioxide and reducing it to organic matter, which eventually would become oil if you could wait 100 million years, but you can't. But we must use it on an annual basis. Now, the green parts of the world, that is, the green plants of the world, are the
devices that we have for collecting the sun, collecting the energy of the sun, and using it to reduce the carbon dioxide into organic matter, usually into sugars. Almost all green plants make sugar first, and then from sugar they make everything else. They make wood, they make, and it turns out they make proteins, and it turns out also that they make oil. The one hydrocarbon which the plants make, well, this picture is simply a diagram of that fact. I'm going to turn this off again. Wait a minute, that isn't what I want to do. There. Well, I guess I have to turn this off so you can see it. And this is simply a schematic to show that the green plant makes all these things that we are after. And the question is, can we find those green plants that make them on a sufficiently high rate, at a sufficiently high rate, and in the right form, so that we can use them on an annual basis? And I'm going to spend the next 30 minutes trying to persuade you that that is possible. In fact, it has already been begun in some parts of the world. The next picture is a picture of the sugarcane in Puerto Rico. There are two kinds of sugarcane in this photo. One, which is ordinary sugarcane over here on the right, and now they're beginning to grow this cane, which was rejected 20 years ago as not very productive. The reason being that the sugar content of the giant cane, the so-called energy cane, is about half per unit weight of the sugar content of Gran Cultura, which is over here. That means that you have to process twice as much mass to get the same amount of sugar that you do here. And of course, that's the reason that most sugar producers selected these small canes with high sugar content, 14% or thereabouts, rather than these giant canes, which have only about 7% sugar. But the actual amount of sugar per acre is about the same in both. You simply have to process twice as much dry matter. Well, now that we need the energy contained in that dry matter, that's becoming an economic thing to do in Puerto Rico. In fact, they're growing that energy cane in Puerto Rico as a fuel for a power plant that was built on the south coast of Puerto Rico, dependent upon Venezuelan oil, which they can no longer get. And so they now have to grow their fuel, and they're doing it by growing this kind of energy cane. Now, in Brazil, which is the largest sugarcane producing country in the world, they realized that they would have to use some kind of a plant, namely sugarcane, as a source of liquid fuel, not just as a fuel for their power plants, but as a source of liquid fuel for their mobile plants, automobiles. And in 1975, when we first visited Brazil, 74, I guess, when we first visited Brazil, they had made 700 million liters of fermentation alcohol from the molasses of 100 million tons of sugar. In 1975, they changed their program and decided to grow cane directly for sugar juice, not for sugar, but for sugar juice, which could be fermented directly to alcohol. And they were thus able to get 10 or 15% more fermentable sugar that way. By 1982, that's the end of this crop year, they had produced in this crop year 4.2 billion liters of fermentation alcohol as a source, mostly of motor fuel, for motor fuel. And they were beginning now to think of this alcohol as the raw material for a petrochemical industry. It's very easy to make ethylene from alcohol, which is the basis of all the petrochemical industry. Well, now, that is the beginning. It has already begun, and as I say, the Brazilians are well on the way to leading the world in this respect. But not the only ones. The Japanese have picked it up, and
When I first heard this, I sort of smiled to myself. I said, well, they really don't have any land. And they said, oh, yes, we do. We have Okinawa. And sure enough, they first began their plantations on Okinawa. They have since expanded to other parts of Southeast Asia, and they now have a large plantation in Thailand of a plant called Calotropis, which is a milkweed. It's a milkweed. It's a plantation in Thailand, a Japanese plantation in Thailand, of a milkweed called Calotropis, which I'm sure grows all over Canada. It's a very tough milkweed. This produces a latex, which is about one-third oil. And the other, there's a small percentage of protein in it, but it's mostly water, of course, one-third oil and two-thirds water. And there is sugar in the plant as well, which can be used to ferment, can be fermented to alcohol. Now, that plantation is only a year old, and I don't have any yield data on that one. I do have yield data on the same plant in Puerto Rico, harvested from the wild, and I'll give you the yield data in a moment because it turns out to be very similar to the plant that we chose first in California. A member of the family Euphorbiaceae, which is, well, I guess this must have stopped. Well, I thought I had more time. That stopped.
Oh, you got lots of time.
I'm sorry about that.
You've got another half hour.
I have? You sure?
Yes.
All right, thank you. You're the program manager. You ought to know. well, I'm going to go quickly through the remaining plants. I'll just show you a picture of the plant in Southern California. This is the plantation of a euphorb in Southern California. This belongs to the family Euphorbiaceae, which is the family that contains the genus Hevia, which is the rubber tree of Brazil. Now, the rubber is the only commercial hydrocarbon crop today. Rubber is exactly the same stuff as oil. It's made of carbon atoms and hydrogen atoms. It's only a matter of how they're arranged. You arrange them one way, and they're rubber. You arrange them another way, and it's oil. It's the same stuff. And we can make rubber out of oil. We could even make oil out of rubber if you were stupid enough to do that. But you don't really want to do that because, as you know, rubber is something like 50 cents a pound and oil is 5 cents a pound. So at least that's the way it used to be. And you're not going to make oil out of rubber. We know how to make rubber out of oil, and we have done that. And it has prompted the yield improvement of the rubber industry in Malaysia from 200 pounds per acre, which it was before the war, to 2,000 pounds per acre, which it is today. And there are small plantations which are making as much as 4,000 pounds per acre. This is to give you some idea of what you can do with the genetic selection of a wild plant when you have to. The Malaysians didn't have to do it for 100 years because there was nothing to compete with them. There was no one who could make rubber. But during the last war, both the Americans and the Germans, for the same reason, the Americans couldn't get Malaysian rubber because the Japanese prevented them, and the Germans couldn't get Malaysian rubber because the Americans prevented them. And the result was they both learned how to make synthetic rubber out of oil. And the Malaysians saw the handwriting on the wall in 1945 and improved their yield by a factor of 10 after 100 years of cultivation. I want you to realize that because the yields I'm going to give you now are yields of wild plants. This is the plant that I have most data on, and it produces 6 barrels of oil per acre per year and 6 barrels of alcohol per acre per year. Well, an amount of sugar that would give 6 barrels of alcohol per acre per year. So we have roughly 12 barrels of liquid fuel per acre per year from this plant. And the same thing, same kind of yield is obtainable from Calotropis, that milkweed that you saw in Thailand. Now, the method of extraction is a very simple one. You simply dry the plant and extract it with a solvent, much the same way as you extract soybean oil from soybeans. And this shows the laboratory process of extraction. I'll just mention it quickly here. Here's the solvent. You put the
dried plant in that thimble. You boil the solvent goes up through this tube, condenses, and runs down through the thimble, back in here, then goes up again, over and over again. Eventually, you get this black oil out of it. You see this here, this black oil, and this is what's left over. And that gives rise to the definition of a commercial process, which is shown in the next slide. And this shows you what you can get with on 1,000 dried tons a day from 30,000 acres. You get 80 tons of oil, and you get 200 tons of sugar, which is about 100 tons of alcohol. And that's where that six barrels comes from. The details of that process need not concern you. Now, the quality of the oil, that black oil that you saw in the previous picture, has been subjected to cracking by Mobil Oil Corporation, and the products are shown in this picture, and you see you get mostly gasoline. See, this C8 is octane, high-octane gasoline. That's what that is. And you make a few other things as well. So it's just exactly what the doctor ordered for the oil companies, if they'll do it. Now, what we would like, of course, is to... let me tell you what that oil is made out of. The black oil that was cracked here was made out of molecules that contain 30 carbon atoms each. And we know a good bit of how they're made. They're made 5 carbon atoms at a time. You add 5 to 5 and make 10, and add another 5 to make 15. In fact, the next slide shows that. Don't worry about the details of it. You start with 5 and you make 10, then you add 5 more and you make, this is C10. You add 5 more, you make C15. You add 5 more, you make C20, and so on to rubber. And in the plant that I showed you, it goes from 2 15s come together to make a 30, and it stops there at 30. Now, I'd like to stop it at 15, because 15 is about the size of diesel fuel. And it turns out there is a tree in Brazil, again in Brazil, which does exactly that. It stops at 15. And the next picture shows you that tree being harvested for the oil. There's a plug in the tree. They're pulling out the plug. This is a machete here, and if you look carefully, you can see the oil dripping off the machete into the dish and through the man's fingers onto the ground. And that oil is all made of 15 carbon atom materials, not 30s. That is directly useful as diesel fuel. And in fact, the Brazilians are now trying to make plantations of those trees for just that purpose. And what I'm going to show you now is a picture Mrs. Calvin took in Brazil, in the deep forest in Brazil, a year ago last August, in the midst of a rainstorm. It's a 2-year-old tree. Here is the tree, the 2-year-old tree, 1 year in a pot and 1 year in the forest. And they planted 500 of those to get some idea as to how fast they can grow them and what yield they can get per unit of area of land. This is just the beginning of a diesel plantation, if you like. They're using the wild trees just as they use the wild rubber trees. And we know approximately what you can get from one wild tree, but you don't know how many you can plant on a plantation yet, and that's what they're trying to find out. Now, we can't grow those trees in North America. Maybe on the southern tip of Florida, if it lasts that long, we might be able to grow it. But that's about all. What we would like to do is to take the cells or the mechanism from the cells of that tree and put it into a plant that will grow in North America. That's what I call by engineering the growing of hydrocarbons. And there are some trees that already grow in the United States, in North America, that do produce the C10s. And this is one of them. And you see the nut of this tree, Pittosporum, is so rich in C10 oils, it's burned directly. But what we would like is to use the get the C15s, one with 15 carbon atoms, and so we have germinated the seed of that Brazilian tree in Berkeley, but that had to be done in a growth chamber, you know, because the climate wasn't right, even in California. It can't grow those trees outdoors in California. We have to grow them in a box where we keep a 12-hour day, 12-hour night. We have an 80-degree Fahrenheit day, a 70-degree Fahrenheit night, and then the seeds germinate and they
grow. And here we have some of the little seedlings done in just that way. And so we now have in Berkeley those little plantlets, those little plants, from which we hope to get the apparatus that makes these 15 carbon atom diesel fuel for us. Now, in order to do that, in order to put it into a plant that will grow in the United States, we want to do it, we have to do some cell biology. We have to grow those plants in single cells, forms, and then marry the cells, if you like. That's one way to do it, fuse the cells. And we've begun that work. The next slide shows a picture of single protoplast cells isolated from, these are single cells now, they're about the size of blood, one blood cell. Each one of these is about the size of one blood cell. These are protoplasts. The green part, of course, is the chloroplast inside the protoplast. And the these cells were obtained from the Euphorbia lathris, that one of that plant that grows in Southern California, or all over California for that matter, and all over the United States. So we now have these cells and can grow them. And in fact, we have learned how to fuse these cells. And the way we did that was to take two batches of these cells and stain them with two different fluorescent dyes so we could tell one cell from the other. And then we allowed them to fuse, and when any of those cells fused with the two different colors of dye, two different colors of fluorescent dye, they would, one was a red and one was a yellow fluorescent, and when they fused, we got some cells that had both yellow and red fluorescence in them, and that is shown in the next slide. Here you see the dye, the cells with only red fluorescence, and here you see the yellow fluorescence, but there are a few of them that show both. This one shows red and yellow, and this one shows red and yellow. The principal one is one of these, I think. This is the easiest one to see both the red and the yellow on. That shows you that we can fuse the cells. These are not two different kinds of cells yet. These are the same cells. These are both from Lathris. We're just learning. Hello, and this one shows red and yellow. The principal one is one of these, I think. This is the easiest one to see both the red and the yellow on. That shows you that we can fuse the cells. These are not two different kinds of cells yet. These are the same cells. These are both from Lathris. We're just learning how to do the fusion and how to separate the fused cells from the unfused ones. Now you see, here these are a mixture of cells, both fused and unfused. And what we want to do is to separate out the ones that have been fused from all the others. So we let them go past a little device, which I think is shown in the next picture. Yes. Here they are. Here are the red fluorescent cells and the yellow fluorescent cells, and this is the fused cell. Now we put it through we put this mixture of all three of these through a fine tube, and we look at the fluorescence of the cells as they come through that tube, one at a time. The cells go through the tube one at a time, and we can sort out the cells that have mixed fluorescence from those that don't. See, these are both, these are red fluorescence and green or yellow fluorescence, and the ones that have only one kind go straight on through. The ones that have both kinds are deflected to the side, and we can separate the fused cells from the unfused ones. So we can select the cells that have both kinds of apparatus in them and hopefully regrow them into plants. Now, so far, we have not done that with a fused cell of two different species, but we have been able to regrow from single cells like that a whole plant. And this shows the first plantlet that was obtained from a single protoplast. This is a whole plant now with root and all. You can't see the root on that photo, but it's a whole plant, a little plantlet, if you like. I don't call it a seedling because it didn't come from a seed. It came from a single cell of that Euphorbia lathris plant. And we now know how to do that. So now our last task is to get some protoplasts from the diesel tree and marry them to the protoplasts of this one and see what kind of a plant you get. Now, it's a moot question whether you get a plant at all, but it's going to be an interesting experiment, and that's where we are today. And in conclusion,
if that fails, and it might, in fact, there's every reason from the point of view of plant biologists to suppose that that will fail, because what little evidence we have of attempts to fuse two cells of different genera, usually what happens is the chromosomes of one of them is ejected, is rejected, and only one of them survives. You don't get mixing of the chromosomes when you do that most of the time. Now, whether that will happen with these plants or not, we don't yet know. But if it does, we have an alternative, more difficult alternative, but an alternative. You've all heard of genetic engineering, where you take a gene, chemically take it out of one organism and chemically put it in another organism. And that can be done. It has been done by taking genes from mammalian cells and putting them into bacteria, having them expressed in the bacteria to produce the stuff that the mammalian cell produces. The question is, can we do it with plants? From one eukaryotic plant to another, from one plant with a nucleus to another plant with a nucleus, and put them together at will. And in a sense, it's man-made evolution, and that what the next slide simply shows that. Let me turn this off here. Well, I guess I have to turn this off and that on. Yeah, that's good enough. You can see it. What this says is we're going to take the gene out of the donor cell. Here's getting the gene out of the donor cell. We're going to clone it in the bacterium and then put it into an acceptor cell and have the new plant have that particular capability built into it. That's a long way off, but it's one of the alternatives that's available to us. So, either we grow it today with the plants that we have, or we build plants that will make what we want them to make. One or the other. I think what we have to do now is to grow the ones that we can grow. And that means milkweeds and euphorbias and pittosporum and things of this kind that will grow in the North America. Well, all over Europe for that matter. In the meantime, we have to try to build the kind of a plant that will make what we want it to make instead of taking the ones that exist and trying to adapt ourselves to what they make. And that, I think, is the next step in this kind of an activity. Finally, in the ultimate sense, finally, we will dispense with the plants entirely. We will learn how the plants do it, and we'll do it with a totally synthetic device. And that's really another lecture. Thank you very much. Oh, I didn't show the last slide. No, it's just a pretty picture. All right, I'll show it to you. It's just a pretty picture. It shows what the world might look like if we succeed. That is a plant that is a euphorb growing in Ethiopia. It's Euphorbia abyssinica. And the hills in the background are covered with that plant. And in fact, in 1938, the Italians were in a bind. They didn't have any oil, and they were at war in Abyssinia, and so they tried to make oil out of that plant. But they didn't have time there either, because they had to get out in 1939, as you know. Thank you very much. Oh, yes, we put on the lights.
Professor Calvin has agreed to answer questions.
To try. There's one up there.
Right. Today on television today, they demonstrated separating of the hydrogen.
No, they didn't.
Well,
no, they didn't. I know what you're
Would you repeat the question?
The question is, that he says on television they demonstrated separating hydrogen from oxygen out of water. They didn't do that. They demonstrated the use of hydrogen, not the not the separation. That's the working. So am I. there are at least 24 people all over the world working on that, and all of them have had some degree of success. And what I meant when I at the end when I said ultimately we will learn how the plants do it and do it without the plants, that's what I'm talking about. Yes. I know you did. It's not true. I'm sorry about that. I know you have no other alternative to believing that, but now you do. You see, now you do. you know, this business of making hydrogen has been going on for. Well, first of all, the man who said that is a man who's been, who's been a spokesman for what he calls the hydrogen economy. And there's no question but what that's a good idea, to work and use hydrogen as a major fuel. The only trouble is nobody knows how to make it. They all know how to use it, and Bockwurst knows how to use it too, so do I. But how to make it? From the sunshine at something like, well, even 15% efficiency if you could do it, would be great. That'd be great. One way of doing it is to make a photovoltaic cell, you know, a silicon cell, at $30 a square foot. You know, you need a few square miles of that, and you might get enough hydrogen to do something that way. That way you can do it. But that's the only way today. In the future, we'll be able to do it directly, photochemically, directly, just the way the plants do it. In the future, not today. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Yes. You mentioned the increase in the carbon dioxide albedo and associated with coal burning and oil burning. What about the contributions from cutting down the forests and the animals?
Ah, yes. Yeah.
Vulcanism.
Yeah. Well, vulcanism isn't so important as making cement. Actually, that's more important than vulcanism, but. Cutting down a forest is a serious problem because not only do you remove a sink when you cut down the trees, but you expose the organic matter of the soil when you cut the trees. And that then microbially is very swiftly converted into CO2. That constitutes a serious but not overwhelming source of CO2. Nothing compared to what the coal does. Nothing at all. I mean, 10-15%. But the cutting of forests can't go on indefinitely. In fact, it's got to stop because there aren't any indefinite number of forests to cut. So I'm not so much worried about that as I am about burning of coal by a long way. First of all, the coal produces, there's much more coal to burn than there are forests to cut, let me put it that way. So that's a serious problem, and one should be avoided not only for CO2, but for cutting the forests themselves. That's a stupid thing to do. But I wouldn't stop cutting them just for CO2. I stop cutting them for other reasons, much more important reasons. Yes?
What fraction of present fossil fuel use would you expect to replace by cultivated sources?
One Arizona, at 60 million acres roughly, at the level that we're now growing, you know, that's roughly 10 barrels per acre, will produce about 10% of our use today. One Arizona. Now, to give you some idea of how many Arizonas we've got, I have some numbers here. In the United States, we have a total of 434 million acres, cropland is 434 million acres. Grazing and pasture land, 943 million, almost a billion acres. And forest and woodland, another 800 million acres. Now, it's out of that grazing and pasture land and some of the cropland. I'm counting tobacco as a crop. To be transformed into oil-producing crops. And I think we will have no difficulty getting at least 200 million acres without any impingement on food production at all. Now, you can't grow food without energy, so you got to have both. And so there's going to have to be a balance there. And that's where we're going to end up at, and not end, but that's where we're going to get to in the next decade. Your question then is answered by saying that 100 million acres will easily make, I think, 20% of our needs in the United States, which is a large amount. And that isn't a very big acreage, you see, in terms of the total acreage. Yes?
What is the cost of fertilizer needed to produce the oil?
Instead of answering that question in dollars, let me answer it in terms of energy. I think that's more useful in any case. The sugar cane growers of Brazil are totally self-sufficient. They grow their cane, extract the sugar, ferment the sugar, the juice to alcohol, burn the bagasse. They have to burn that bagasse in furnaces to generate steam to distill the alcohol and concentrate the sugar juice and distill the alcohol in that order. And when they burn the bagasse, they get the minerals of the ash, which they put back. Now they've got more bagasse than they need steam for running the sugar mill. And so they run that steam through steam turbines and make electricity. And with the electricity, they fix nitrogen, they make ammonia, and then put that back on the soil. So it's all contained. There's no net extra cost in running the sugar business and making alcohol. No extra cost in energy. There's cost in capital of building the plants, but no extra cost in energy. Does that answer your question? I think that's a better way to answer it than dollars.
Is that Brazil?
That's in Brazil, yes. Yes?
You mentioned three countries that had a very high consumption of coal. Russia, China, Germany.
In the United States. Well, you got us just a month too soon. We're going to China next month, and I'll find out. We're going to China just for that reason. In fact, they've asked us to come for just that reason. So I think they're doing something. That's all I can tell you. The Russians tried it and are developing it. The Russians tried it, as usual, 30 years ago. I didn't find that out until I went to Beltsville, you know, where the USDA is. The big, have I got the right name? Yeah. I get Beltsville and Bethesda mixed up. Beltsville, where the main big lab of the USDA is, and I talked about this, and a week later they sent me a bunch of reprints saying the Russians began 30 years ago to grow these Essula, to be exact, which is another euphorb very closely related to the Lathyrus, and which in our country and in Canada is a pest on the range. That cattle won't eat it, and the cattlemen are trying to destroy it. I think the time is coming when the cattlemen will make a crop out of it instead of meat, so that we'll have oil as well from them. So, you ask, are the Russians and the Chinese doing anything? I think they are, but I can't answer that unambiguously. Yes?
Dr. Sherman and I were part of a trade mission that was down in South Africa in the spring, and we saw where they were turning out from one plant, and they're building two more already, 140,000 tons of coal daily into oil because they have no oil.
Yeah, they're making methanol and then cracking that. That's not good. I didn't realize that the South Africans were burning that much coal to make their methanol, but that's a very large production and a very large source of CO2. Yeah, it's a very large source of CO2, which I should have been aware of. I didn't mention it. I didn't know the numbers. Your numbers are very useful for that in that respect. Yeah. Well, way in back, somebody way in back. I am not sure I understand the question. Is what are we doing to, about preserving our genetic resources? Is that the question? Well, I'm not sure. I'm not destroying them. So whatever they are, we've got them. For what? Genetic resources for what? No, I think our plants are still there. We're not destroying them. In fact, they want to destroy one of them in Nevada because it's a pest on the land, as I said. But I think Escula will turn into a product rather than a pest. I don't understand your question. You see, genetic resources is such a general term until you say genetic resources for what? For people? Or for meat, or for oil, those are all different. They're not the same. So you can't say genetic resources in general. You have to say for what. And if you say for oil, I think we're preserving them. For people, maybe not. I don't know. the farnesyl pyrophosphate cyclase. I'll talk more about that in detail. Wednesday? Is that when it is? Mm-hmm. I didn't try to do that here tonight for obvious reasons. Yes?
Yes, you mentioned that coal was the greatest problem in the greenhouse effect, but that oil is also doing it.
Yes.
What about these new hydrocarbons produced by plants? Are they not also carrying out?
Yes. On a one-year cycle. Not a 100-million-year cycle. Every carbon atom that we burn from plants this year was CO2 last year and will be a hydrocarbon again next year. It's a one-year cycle. Whereas when you're burning coal, you're burning it on a 100-million-year cycle, which is not a human cycle. In other words, it takes 100 million years to get it back. Whereas when you burn it from a plant, it's a one-year thing. In other words, what you burn today was CO2 last year and will be oil again next year. Yes?
How much success are you having with using two cells from different plants?
Well, you're asking right on the front of the line here. And the man who did that, who's that little plant there, has made some fusions already of euphorbs of different species, but that's the same genus. The transgeneric fusion has not yet been achieved.
So it's not really all that popular.
What do you mean popular? It's popular with me. I don't understand what you mean.
No, really, it's just a new technique.
Of course, that's what research is. Everything is new. Everything I'm talking about is new. Everything. And this hydrogen business is even newer because it isn't done yet. No, you got to realize that's what research is, you know? You're always out on the edge of something which nobody's been at before. Otherwise, you know, it's like Columbus. You know, the reason that Columbus was what he is, he said, is that he went someplace nobody else went before. And that's why you remember him. That's why we're here. I mean, I have a cartoon in my office, which I wish I had a picture of. I don't have a picture of it here, which says essentially that. I don't know if you've seen it, Sam. Have you seen it? No. it's a cartoon. I don't know who drew it. Jack Kent drew it. Jack Kent is a cartoonist. You know, he draws funny papers. And he draws a strip called King Aru. Anybody know King Aru? Oh, my. That's pretty bad. Well, I'm sorry. I'll have to send that picture to somebody. It's really a great picture because what he says is, it's a little strip of a discussion between the professor and somebody, I don't know with whom he has a discussion, about what he's doing. Well, he says he doesn't really know what he's doing, but he's doing something nobody else did. And that's the important thing. Yes.
Dr. Calvin, in listening to your lecture, I thought of three aspects of
difficulty?
You have the sap root, which I found very interesting.
Yeah. You mean the diesel tree?
Yes, and from that, coals and tung oil.
Oh, the seed oils. Seed oils, yeah.
Then you have a fermentation process that is in
practice. Sugar, yeah.
What we're trying to do in BC, I believe, well, I'm no chemist, is destructive distillation of...
of wood. Of wood. Well, that makes methanol.
Pine oil.
Yeah. Well, you get terpenes. That's the same thing as that diesel tree makes, and that the pittosporum makes, is what you make in a pine tree. But the amount you make is so small per acre, per tree, that it isn't really economic. You destroy the tree for a small amount of turpentine. That's really what you're doing. And what I'm suggesting, particularly in this pittosporum, the seed, is you get the turpentine, if you like to call it, that's really what it is, from the fruit of the tree. You don't destroy the tree. You harvest the fruit every year. Now, I don't know how much I can get per tree because I've only just started that work. I know it grows in the Philippines, grows in California, it grows in all the way up into Washington. It must be able to grow up here. I don't know whether pittosporum grows up here or not. Are there some species of pittosporum growing up here? Do you know? They're fruits. They're all the same. They have these tiny little seeds in an orange colored fruit, the seed is embedded in a sticky wax, which is the terpenoids, and that's the way you can harvest them without doing any damage to the tree. And in fact, you don't even have to. And that's not only no damage to the tree, but since the tree grows constantly. And you don't replant every year, you don't do any damage to the soil either. So your soil conservation, it's great if you can do it. It's great. That's a great way to do it. I think that's the best way to do it, rather than planting a new plant every year. A field crop is going to wreck the soil ultimately. And I have to agree with the soil conservationists when they say that.
Like the sugar cane.
The sugar cane is one of them. Well, that isn't planted every year either. That's planted every third year, every fourth year. And that isn't as bad. Yeah. They retune it. They cut it and it regrows. Cut it and regrows. They can do that three or four times before the sugar yield falls off. But a better thing would be a tree, which you don't cut, but once every 20 years, something like that. And you just harvest the fruit every year. That would be the ideal situation. And if the fruit now produces the oil that you want, the turpentine, then you have it. And you not only don't have to plant every year and don't do any damage to the tree like you do the pine tree, but you don't you conserve the soil as well. I think that's the best way to go, if we can go that way. And that's why I'm anxious to find out if there are any pittosporum that grows this far north. I know that they grow in Northern California and probably in Oregon, but I don't know they go this far. Yes?
Well, what about the world supply of oxygen? I understand that a great deal of that is generated in the Amazon, in the jungles of the Amazon. A high percentage of the total oxygen we use. Now, this is also tied into preserving the
forest. Oxygen. The forest, yes. Well, after all, the oxygen in the atmosphere is 20%. The CO2 in the atmosphere is 300 parts per million. 0.3%. So that a small change in the forest can have a big effect on the CO2 without having much effect on the oxygen. I'm not so much concerned about that. I think that the oxygen levels will be very hard to move because they already are so high. And there are other sources of oxygen in the plant, although the fact of the matter is that today's atmospheric oxygen is almost all plants, comes from plants, not only the Amazonian forests, but all the green plants of the earth, in the ocean as well. And I don't feel that we're running a risk on oxygen depletion anything like at the anything like as great a risk. It's a skin tight risk on the CO2. It's a loose risk on the oxygen. I don't feel that we're anywhere near the edge of disaster on the oxygen, whereas I think we are on the edge of disaster on the CO2. And the reason is we already the pool of oxygen is enormous. It's 200 times what the pool of CO2 is. And that's why I think the big difference is. But let's get somebody up here. Well, no way, you had a chance. Let's find somebody that doesn't have a chance. Oh, you had a chance, too. There's one up there that didn't have a chance, way up there.
Professor Calvin, would you care to speculate what caused the excess water to put Florida under that amount of water?
Oh, there probably was no Antarctic ice cap in those days. That's 50,000 years ago.
Would that have been a greenhouse effect of some kind?
Oh, there could have been. There could have been more CO2 then. In fact, there was a time when the average temperature of the Earth was a good deal higher than it is today, but there weren't men on the Earth then either. You know, there were dinosaurs and things like that. You know, the average temperature of the Earth has fluctuated considerably. I would say as much as 5 or 10 degrees, which is very large fluctuation, and that would be enough to do just that. But most of those fluctuations have occurred, the large fluctuations have occurred over historical times. For example, in the Carboniferous period, which is almost 300-400 million years ago, the Earth was covered with a tropical, almost the whole Earth was covered with a tropical flora. And CO2 must have been fairly high to make that happen. And the temperature high, too, to make that happen. But there were no men then. No human race then. And that's the difference. I think the change in climate, which we are heading for if this thing goes forward in the obvious direction, is going to be so big and so fast that the human race will not be able to adjust to it. The agricultural patterns of the Earth will change. You know, there'll be places where we can grow things today where we couldn't before. Northern Canada will become, you know, useful. However, the Great Plains, the wheat plains of the United States and Canada will not. They will go away. They will dry up or flood or something like that's going to happen to them. In other words, they won't stay the same. The whole agricultural pattern of the globe is going to change if that happens. And I don't think, and if it happens in a period of 3 or 4 generations, which is what I'm talking about, you know, 50, 100 years, we won't have time to adjust to it. The human race doesn't evolve that fast. And that's what I'm worried about. And it's going to give rise to all sorts of conflicts, and you won't recognize them for what they are when they come.
You
understand what I'm saying? You won't recognize them for what they are when they come.
We have one more question.
Yeah. Can you raise your voice so I can hear you? Well, I don't know. I mean, that's what we're going to try and find out. Yeah, that's what you might expect. But I don't think they have to be fertile. I think they can be cloned. That's what we're doing now. We're cloning them from single cells. They don't have to be fertile. Do you understand what I'm saying? We're growing them from single somatic cells now. They're not going through a haploid stage at all. They're not fertile. We don't require fertility to reproduce the cells, to reproduce the plants. That's the whole point. We're cloning them from somatic cells. And that's that plant that you saw in the last slide was not from a seed, didn't go through a haploid stage, didn't go through a reproductive stage at all. It was a single somatic cell. And it grew into a callus, and then the callus made a shoot, and then a root, and we have a whole plant. That's cloning a plant from a somatic cell. No, we don't have to worry about sterility.
I just assumed that after
Well, there probably would be, but it isn't necessary. That's all I'm trying to say. My concern is a much more basic one than that. I don't know what kind of a plant it would be. I mean, would it be a tree or would it be a bush? And would the oil run out on the ground or would it stay in the plant? I don't know. Would it make oil at all? You know, this is something that's never been done, to make a transgeneric fusion. And that's really, you can't tell what's going to happen. If you succeed in making a plant out of it, what kind of a plant will it be? Don't ask me, I don't know. That's what I'm doing research for, to find out. That's what you ought to do.
Now, I'm going to call on Dr. Aronoff of Simon Fraser University. He was a former dean of science there, a very appropriate person to express our thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, I simply want to ask you to join me in thanking Professor Calvin for this very interesting lecture, as well as for the vigor of his work on food.